He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The word became flesh and his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testifies concerning him. He cries out, saying, "This is he whom I have said, he who comes after me has surpassed me because his grace was before me. From the fullness of his grace we have all received one blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known."
Okay, right. We are starting our Advent series. We've just done months of looking through the book of Proverbs, which has been fantastic. But we're going to do our Advent series, which is this period of waiting that Callum was talking about, as we wait for the gift of the Messiah. This is what we're remembering at this time of year. We're going to do it a little bit different this year. We're going to be using the Gospel of John, just the first chapter of the Gospel of John, to reflect on the person of Jesus, the gift of Jesus Christ. To us this Christmas. And we're going to be looking this morning at two verses up there. John 1:1-2. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Now, I got this verse from Callum, and I put my head in my hands thinking, Callum, what? It's two verses. What have you done to me? You know, we go from the sublime to the ridiculous in Cornerstone. We go from whole chapters of 1 Corinthians to two verses in John's Gospel. So we're just trying to stretch you this morning in this. Anyhow, these are perhaps two of the most profound verses. They're actually very simple. In the Greek, this is a very, very simple sentence. It's not a complicated sentence. But actually, it's probably got more profundity and more depth in it than you could possibly imagine in these two verses. It's astonishing what it says about the person of Jesus to us this morning. So I hope as we dig into this, something of the wonder of who Jesus is and the gift of Jesus will capture our hearts again this Christmas. We're going to be looking at two things this morning, very simply from this passage. In the beginning, God is the creator. That's number one. In the beginning, God is creator. And then number two, God is personal. Two very simple things. God is creator and God is personal, but two things that have profound implications for each of our lives as we think about the gift of Jesus. So in the beginning, God is the creator. I want to read out this quote from G.K. Chesterton, which is just a helpful way into thinking about this passage. He says this. This is in the book Heretics, which he wrote many years ago. But there are some people, nevertheless, and I am one of them, who think that the most practical and important thing about a man is still his view of the universe. We think that for a landlady considering a lodger, it's important to know his income, but still more important to know his philosophy. We think that for a general to know about to fight an enemy, it's important to know the enemy's numbers, but still more important to know the enemy's philosophy. What it's saying is this, is what you think about the universe, where it came from, what it's about, is incredibly practical in your life. It's incredibly practically important. In the beginning, in this passage, in the beginning, immediately as we read this, we're meant to think of Genesis 1. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God. And yet in this passage, we have in the beginning was the Word. the word. And the Greek word for word is the word logos. We've talked about this before on Sunday mornings. And this is an interesting word that he uses because for the Greek speakers he's speaking to, the logos was an incredibly well-known concept that they understood. Logos was the thing that brought rationality and order to the universe. So as they look out at trees and animals and fields and human beings, they were trying to say, well, what brought order to this? What makes sense of this? Why not just a massive pile of mud? And they said that was the logos. The logos brought order to all of this. So we now know, for example, that there is information embedded in everything. There's information embedded in all those trees out there, all those plants. There is information embedded in you, in every single cell of your body. Where did this information come from? This was the logos. For the Greeks, so that's for the Greeks. For the Jews, the logos was also a well-known word that was used. In Psalm 33, verse 6, and Proverbs 8, which we're looking at earlier on in the year, the logos was God. The word of God was a person. He was a person. And what's interesting about these two verses is this, is how John starts off this gospel. How John starts off this gospel. You know, the other gospels start off with genealogies and immediately you're into Bethlehem and the birth of Jesus. But John does something remarkable in this passage. He says, if you truly want to understand Jesus, you need to go back much further than that, to before creation. You need to go to before creation. Jesus is the creator. He is the creator. So Colossians 1:17, in him, in Jesus, all things were created. John starts off his gospel in eternity. Now, why is this important? You know, it means that Jesus is truly God. It means he's truly God. So what he's done to rescue you has implications for eternity. It's not just a wishful thinking or a bit of religion. This has eternal implications. John is writing to persecuted believers who needed to be assured that what they were risking, staking their life on was trustworthy. So the fact he starts his gospel in eternity is incredibly encouraging for these believers. We're suffering now, but this is a blink in the eye compared to eternity, is one of the implications that he talks about in this. You know, we often start off our gospel messages with the message of the fall. You know, you've sinned. You know, you've messed up in your life. And that's a true part of the gospel, no question. But it's interesting, I think we increasingly need to start the gospel where John starts it, in creation. That sin actually only makes sense in the context of the good gift of creation. That we have fallen from something. So if we lose the creator in talking about the gospel, in talking about the reality, if we lose the creator, we lose the gospel entirely. Sin doesn't make sense if there is no creator. So we have to start the gospel story in creation. He is the creator. And the creator, if you're created, then it has a few implications very quickly for your life. It means that you have meaning as a human being, that you have purpose, that you have inherent value as a human being, that you're not the product of random chance and mutations alone, or just that you're basically a bag of large chemicals, but you have a meaningful identity and a purpose. I think everything in us longs for that as human beings. You know, what's really interesting with this whole story of John 1 is that Jesus is outside creation, okay? He's outside in the creation. In the beginning was the Word. Before everything, Jesus was there. So Jesus is uncreated. Very important, very simple sentence, very simple Greek, but Jesus was uncreated. It's very important to see what John is saying here. Jesus is prior to creation. He is the cause of creation. Why does this matter to us this morning? Why is this practical to you this morning in the words of G.K. Chesterton? I was at the British Museum earlier on in the year. I've probably mentioned this a few times. I love the British Museum, okay? Maybe I'm one of the few that love it. Anyhow, I was looking at these tablets, these fragments from libraries in Babylon, ancient Babylon. And one of them was a fragment called the Enuma Elish, which is one of the ancient creation stories from the Babylonian world. One of the earliest stories we know of a creation account that we have of. But it's interesting that the thing is in that story is that the universe is created, but then the gods are created out of the universe, out of the stuff of creation. Okay? Very significant. So the gods emerge out of creation. So creation just is there, and the gods are created out of that. But John 1, Jesus is uncreated. He is uncreated. He is prior to creation. Why does all this matter? You know, what on earth is Phil on about? Well, let me start with this. This is the genius of John chapter 1 and why it's so important that Jesus is uncreated. Alvin Plantinga, who is an influential philosopher, I'll put it on the screen, had this statement at the bottom, which says, all explanations must come to an end. All explanations must come to an end. This is a very influential philosopher in the world today, and his point is this. What he means is that, say the materialist, if you believe that the universe is just matter, that's all that explains life. The world is just the stuff of makes up our bodies, the forces of matter. Then their explanation stops at the fundamental particles. In physics, the fundamental particles are things like quarks and electrons. They are the things undergirding matter. So their explanation stops at that. They have no explanation. The materialist has no explanation for the existence of fundamental particles. They just exist. So where do these particles come from, if you're a materialist? The materialist really hasn't explained reality at all. Huge questions are left in life. You know, in Buddhism, for example, the ground of existence is the great infinity of life. A big kind of circle of infinity, and an impersonal kind of transcendent truth that brings all this about. But where does all this come from? There's no attempt to explain it in Buddhism. Buddhism is more, I think, is probably quite helpfully understood more of as a way of living life, as opposed to an explanation of the world. Eventually, you have to explain the universe. All explanations have to come to an end somewhere. So since the 1960s, we've had the understanding that the creation of the world started at a big bang. And as one of my friends famously said, if you have a big bang, you need a big banger. You need an explanation as to how this all came about in the first place. You know, with the Bible, the explanation of the world stops at there being a mind outside of creation who created it. You know, this explanation comes to an end in God, a mind who guides all the processes of life, that embeds information in cells that we're discovering through science. Far from being fanciful as an explanation, it's increasingly that scientists are saying, many scientists are saying that actually this is the best explanation we've got. How do you explain this stuff in the world? It's the best explanation of the world as it actually is. A created God. A creator God. A created God, by the way, like the Enuma Elish story, is what in the Bible we call an idol. Any God that emerges from creation, from matter, that we create out of our own hands or that we make up with our own imaginations outside from the stuff of the world is called an idol. For God to be truly God, it has to be outside of creation and prior to creation. So it says in Romans 1, we turn away from God and we worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. So we're looking in this passage and Jesus is the creator. This is an astonishing statement. He is the uncreated one. This is the one who was given to us in the incarnation. All explanations come to an end. You know, as G.K. Chesterton says, this is incredibly practical for our life. God as the creator. Jesus as the creator. And it changes everything. You need to have an explanation of this world. So that's the first thing. The second thing we're going to look at is this. God is personal. God is personal. It's interesting, this word, the logos, for those that were from a Greek background, was an impersonal force that brought order to this world. It was an impersonal force. But this word in John 1 was with God. He was with God. God is a person. God is not a blind force. He's not elementary particles, but a person. You know, underneath everything is a person. This, again, is in the words of G.K. Chesterton, is incredibly practical for us. It's immensely practical to understand. Not only has reality got a person at the foundation of it, but it has love at the bottom of it. It has love. Reality has love at the bottom of it. You know, you have in John 1, Jesus, the Word, being with God. You have the members of the Trinity interacting in relationship. And if you have relationship between persons, you have love. So this is why it says in 1 John chapter 4 that God is love. That God is not on his own. He is in relationship. So in the very heart of who God is, you have love. I think this is astonishing. Astonishing to reflect on in the foundation of reality is love, is a person. You know, we cannot live without relationships in life. It makes total sense to me that at the bottom of reality is a person. That behind everything is a person I can relate to. You know, if I locked you in a sealed room which had food and drink, but no windows and no contact with people on the outside, then it should probably lock me up if I ever did that. But anyhow, but you would go insane without interaction with other people. You cannot live without relationship. It's a central part of what it means to be human, to relate to others, person to person. It's a central part of what it means to be human. You know, your very life, therefore, tells you that to lose the ability to relate to others is death. And doesn't it make total sense then that the foundation of reality is a person in whom we are to have a relationship? I think it's astonishing that a foundation of reality is a person who is love. You know, I put this picture up here of the stars. You know, when you look up at the stars, and the answer to this question will tell you a lot about what you really believe about this world. When you look up at the stars, do you see sheer emptiness, an impersonal reality as you look up? Or do you see something that shouts of the reality of God, of a personal being who created this? How do you view this world? What is the way you view the universe? It has immense practical implications for your life. A personal being who created all of this out of love, who is a person. You know, it's worth bearing in mind that this gospel, this is mind-blowing, this gospel was written by John. John, who was with Jesus, who put his head on the shoulder of Jesus Christ, who is the creator. We're talking about intimacy and personal relationship with God himself. He literally put his head on the shoulder of Jesus. It's astonishing intimacy and personal connection between a human being and God himself. So we're not just talking about airy-fairy ideas here about a personal relationship with God. We're talking about reality. And John writes this out of his own experience. He's writing about the creator whose shoulder he put his head on and rested. Do you see how mind-blowing this is? This is just absolutely stunning what we're talking about at Christmas time, the gift of Jesus Christ in our world. The Creator is this personal to us. He can be this personal. If God is personal, if he is a person, then what does that mean for you? It means that you can truly relate to him person to person. You know, there's a huge amount of confusion about what it means to relate to God. You know, God is not like us. You know, our relationship to God is not one of equals on a platform. You know, he is the creator, we are the creature. So there is differences in this relationship, okay? You know, you don't see God physically. But a real personal relationship is the expectation of the Bible. It is the expectation of the Bible. God walked with Adam and Eve in the garden. He walked with Adam and Eve in the garden. We have no idea how much havoc sin has caused to our perception of what it means to have a personal relationship with God. We have no idea as to the damage that has caused to our perception of these things. But as Christians, we're seeking to relearn what it means to have a personal relationship with God in the knowledge that he welcomes us into his presence. I guess one question I want to reflect on this morning is, how do you build relationships? You know, how do you build any relationship in life? How do you do that? You use time. You need time. You need effort to build that relationship. You need to listen well. You need to give people attention. That's how you build normal human relationships. As it is in normal human relationships, so it is with God in many ways, with the personal God. Time, effort, listening, attention. But one key aspect I want to talk about building relationships is very, very relevant when it comes to building to relations to God, and that's the issue of trust. That trust is the foundation of any good relationship. Trust is at the foundation of all good relationships, from marriage relationships to all other relationships in life. How do you build trust with someone? You know, you give them time. As I've said, you listen well. You share honestly about yourself. You know, you don't hide stuff in your life if you want to build trust. You don't hide stuff in your life. You're vulnerable. You build trust by learning to rely on other people. In other words, they are trustworthy in life. Does that make sense? It's a very simple concept. They are trustworthy. You increasingly rely on people and build trust. As it is in human relationships, so it is with God. So it is with God. Trust is the foundation of love. You know, if I don't trust my wife, I can't love her. Without trust, I can't love her. I can't express love. I can't receive love from her if I don't trust her. You know, if you lose trust, love and intimacy will decline in a relationship. If you lose trust, love and intimacy, that real connection between people will decline in a relationship. So the key question is this, with regard to the God who is personal. He is personal. Who is a person? How do I grow in trust of God? I think this has been one of the most helpful questions I've learned to ask other people and myself. How do I learn to, where is God inviting me to trust him right now in my life? It's a very practical question. But this is what builds relationship. This is what builds intimacy with God. Where is God inviting me to trust him right now? Let me give you some examples. In John's gospel up here on the screen, his stated purpose in John, of the whole gospel of John is in John chapter 20, verses 30 to 31. It says this: Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. And the word believing there is the word for faith, but it's also the word that we could translate trust. I often translate it trust because I think it makes more sense in our culture. That you are trusting not in a, you're not having blind faith in a vague concept. You have trust in a person who is God. How do you receive the grace of Jesus? How do you receive all that he's done? By trusting in that, in your life. So trust is at the center of how we receive Jesus in the first place. That's what faith is, trusting. It's the Colossians 1, verse 12. We've been meditating on this last week. There's this beautiful little statement in verse 12 where it says, we give joyful thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of his holy people in the kingdom of light. Do you trust this? He has qualified you. He has qualified you. You haven't qualified yourself to be in the kingdom of light. He qualified you through Jesus Christ and what he's done on the cross. He has qualified you to share this inheritance. And all you have to do is trust it. Grasp hold of this and trust it in your life. Do you trust this? Do you trust these statements of the gospel? You know, in trusting Jesus, you don't become vague creatures of God. You become children of God. You're brought into relationship by whom we cry, Abba, Father. Like, this is a deeply personal reality that the scriptures are talking about here. A deeply personal reality. I put a statement down there which has been really influential to me over the last 3 or 4 years, where it's from a guy called Bill Thrall, and he says this: truth transforms, but only truth that is trusted can truly transform. Truth transforms, but only truth that is trusted can truly transform. And I want to explain this. I've got lots of theology qualifications. So I've got 2 master's degrees in theology. I started a PhD in theology, which I had to stop because of business. I like theology. I like understanding what the Bible says. I've got lots of background in that. Well, one of the things that's really struck me in recent years is it's not about how much you know. It really isn't about how much you know. It's what you trust of what you know. Yeah, so I've really I can have all that knowledge, but what do I do with it? And it was an incredible challenge to me to realize it. Like, I have a tremendous responsibility to actually trust what I know rather than just talk about it. Do I actually trust this? I think there are people in heaven who know very little theology, but they trust it in such a profound way that they will be the heroes. It's not about how much you know, it's about what you trust of what you know. It's what you trust of what you know. I love theology. I'm not arguing against good learning. I'm passionate about it. Just a little caveat there for you. It's what you trust of what you know. You know, lots of Christians talk about intimacy with God. It was this kind of language which I grew up with, talking about we need intimacy with God and we need to grow in intimacy with God. And it was language that disempowered me as a young Christian, because I was like, what does that mean? Like, I can have intimacy with a person. What does intimacy with God actually mean? What are we talking about? I'm not someone that just kind of receives stuff. I question stuff all the time, which can be a bit annoying to other people. Anyhow, so I was just like, I don't know what that means. So I'm just going to kind of park it until I understand what we're talking about here. But let me explain what this does mean, because it's incredibly important to think about this. We can have intimacy with God. I've reclaimed this language in my life. If I don't trust my wife, I don't have intimacy with her. In the same way with God. If I don't practically trust him in the nitty-gritty of my life, I won't have intimacy with him. Simple as that. It really is as simple as that. Intimacy is about trust. Intimacy is about trust. If you want to build intimacy, build trust. Rely on God, lean on God increasingly in your life. You know, maturity is about actually trusting what you know in life. I've been in a number of Bible studies with students over the years, and there's a few occasions when I've had a student open up the Bible study and look at it and think, well, I heard a sermon on that once, I'm just going to shut it up and put it away. Like, literally. And I think what's interesting is that that was a kind of based on the assumption that if you've heard it once and you know something in your head, that's all you need to do as a Christian. You just need to know it in your head. It's kind of cognitive. I can repeat cognitively what that passage says. That's absolute nonsense. It's not about what you know. It's about what you trust of what you know. So if we ever think we can shut our Bibles because we know it, we're making a huge mistake. We should never be shutting our Bibles. We should always have that question of, Lord, how can I trust you in this? You know, I think there's this there's this kind of viewpoint in the church which can be a bit like, if you just have the right knowledge and you get the right information across, and that's going to bring transformation. It's not. It's what you trust of what you've heard that makes the difference, not what you've heard. You've got to learn to trust this. You've got to enact trust in what you know in the Christian life. Just delivering information doesn't bring transformation. It doesn't bring intimacy. It's what you trust of what you know. It's interesting, the evil one knows more theology than perhaps the best theologians that we have ever known. But the evil one doesn't trust that theology. He's very clever. What do you trust of what you know? It's incredibly important to think about this. Let me give you some other examples, briefly, of what it means to trust God in your life. When it comes to the issue of sin, for example, the issue of sin actually comes down to a question of trust. So, for example, where do I believe that life will be found? Do I believe that life will be found in the way of trusting Jesus and saying no to some things and knowing that he is the way to life? Do I trust that Jesus is the way to life? Or do I trust my old strategies of sin? I think that is going to give me satisfaction. That's what I really want. Am I going to trust in the old ways of Phil? You know, what do I trust? The question in any act of sin is a question of trust. Do I actually trust what Jesus says is true, that he is the way to life? Therefore, I can say no to this. So any act of sin is a question of trust. Let's talk about the issue of fear as another example. I felt the last couple of 48 hours, I just felt oppressed by fear about something in my life. I think one of the things I've realized is that, you know, when you face situations of fear that kind of come on you, and I think it's been a spiritual dynamic as well, by the way. You know, in the face of fear, we have two human responses, flight or fight. You know, fight is, right, I'm going to control the situation, I'm going to deal with it, I'm going to handle it. You know, this is how I'm going to handle this fear. The other option is that you run away from it and you just avoid it at all costs. And we always do one or other. And actually, one of the things I've been reflecting on is I've seen, as been reflecting about this fear, both of those responses in my life, both temptations in my life. But I think one of the questions that I've been asking in the last 24 hours even is just like, what does it mean to trust God with the situation that I feel fear in? Lord, where are you inviting me to trust you right now? And as I bring God into the center of my fears, I then can see a bit clearer as to what is the appropriate response. Maybe there will be some action that is required. Maybe I don't need to kind of run away from it. Maybe I need to do something practically. But with God right at the center of it, it changes your perspective. It says, Lord, how can I trust you in this? And actually, whatever happens in life, he is holding you. When you bring God into the center of situations of fear and anxiety, it transforms that perspective. This is real stuff. Working out the trust and the nitty-gritty of life. And he speaks into those situations and you begin to discern the right path and the right response that is Christ-like and reflects him and puts God at the center of these situations, rather than my own strategies or my own anxieties of withdrawal, whatever it is. You know, in human relationships, we see trust between us and God manifest in the way we relate to one another all the time. So, for example, you know, a colleague who doesn't respect you at work, what do you do? You know, they don't give you credit where you think credit is due in your workplace. Do you assert yourself in the face of that person? Take that person down in your head? Or do you shrink into self-recrimination and doubt in your life and withdraw in annoyance? What do you do? How do we bring trust right into the center of these nitty-gritty situations in our life? I think as we bring God into them, there's a strength to know that he holds us. No matter what the verdict of that person, his verdict is sure in my life. He holds me. He's given me a word that should put all other words in perspective in my life. You know, when people say things to you, it just drops off you that little bit easier because you've got a word being spoken into your life of assurance and love that is far more significant than any other word in your life, or it should be, because it's a word from the Creator, from the Eternal One, the Uncreated One. Now, let me finish with this. Trust is challenging. You know, if you really want to experience God, you need to press into trusting God where it most hurts, often where the challenge is the biggest. Lord, what does it mean to trust you right now in the midst of this situation? We're so used to working out strategies of control or avoidance. What does it mean to trust you right now in these situations? Building trust takes time, as I said before, effort, attention, you know, studying the word, listening to God, bringing him into the nitty-gritty realities of our lives, of our complicated hearts. But he brings real transformation into these. So the question to you guys is, John 1:1-2, this is a personal God, the Creator God, the Eternal One. Where is he inviting you to trust him right now, even this morning? Where is he inviting you to trust him in your life? And I suggest an answer to that question, you go to that area where you're most in turmoil or struggle. That's where you experience the intimacy of God as you seek to bring him and his word into these situations. You know, when we see, you know, just thinking this week, you know, when Jesus comes back, maybe we'll still be alive, maybe we won't. But when the dawn of Jesus comes and he arrives on the clouds, on that day, I just wonder if we'll all kind of put our hands on each other's shoulders and just say something a bit like, I wish I'd invested more time in this. I wish I'd appreciated the reality of this, how personal he is. I just wish I'd invested more in this. May we all, by God's grace, go on this adventure of trusting him, of growing in intimacy with him, and enjoying him evermore.